He is Justin Davis, user experience designer and bringer of bourbon.
I knew you were going to say that, and I was going to say you should have said bearer of bourbon to go with the bearer token little bit. Either way, he is Aubrey Goodman, web services and dev extraordinaire and Sultan of Sendoffs.
Oh.
Here and
there we go.
There you go. And this is a little show that we like to call Distilled Today with Extra Distillation.
Actual bourbon.
Yeah.
For our enjoyment and not yours.
Right. Yes, indeed. Well, I mean, you're more than welcome to play along at home if you'd like. You can order the Distilled Game, which comes with an empty bottle of bourbon that you can fill up with the bourbon of your choice.
Yeah, with a
board with no squares on it.
Stamped envelope. To send it to us after doing so.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Bottles of piss will be returned to sender.
Yeah, exactly.
A little less full than they received. Don't ask why.
I love it.
I may cut that part.
So you can, you can find us online at Distilled Radio or distilledpodcast.com. Also on Twitter at Distilled Radio. You can find me, Justin Davis, at JWD2A on Twitter. And Aubrey is at Aubrey Goodman on Twitter, a much more sensible name than I have. You want to hear something on the show, just hashtag it Distilled Topics. Or just send us hateful DMs on Twitter, or write your question on the side of a vintage 1956 bourbon and mail it to us, and we'll handle that as well.
Yes, and by handle he means the 1.75 bottle.
That's the one. Yes.
Yes. So,
so we actually have like an actual real tech topic.
We're not just bullshitting. I mean, we are actually.
Well, which is the standard.
But not bullshitting about nonsense that no one fucking cares about.
Right.
Oh, and I should also mention that the experts level of the drinking game for Distilled, for those of you who want to stay at home and join us in the drinking, is every time someone curses, you have to drink a shot. So
Shit. You
will probably want to call the ambulance in about 12 minutes.
Yeah, that's a fucking nightmare.
Oh,
I mean, fuck.
Fuck. Yeah.
Shit.
What will we fucking do?
I can't fucking believe it. So. you can now get rid of that empty bottle.
Yes.
And
don't send it to us.
Move on to that Everclear that you've had sitting in the in the closet for the past however many years it was since you were in college.
So today, as with recent episodes about the non-interview style episodes, we're talking about APIs again.
Yeah.
And kind of like...
In a way, this is a wonderful full circle moment.
It is. Although we did say that last time we talked about APIs, which I believe is last week in the,
The
publishing schedule. Although, who can keep up with when that happens?
Yeah.
Certainly not.
We have other people upstairs who do all the publishing for us.
And he's not talking about God either.
No.
God is a terrible
the oppressive
publisher.
The oppressive management upstairs.
Shakes fist.
That's right.
Are we both atheists now? Is that?
So
this week, Justin asked on Twitter, "Hey guys, does anybody know what you do if there's a best practice for versioning APIs in a published way with a Node web service?"
Right.
Because, insert backstory here.
Because. I am working on a new version of Drawer, which is a big release, and a lot of what we're doing changes a lot of the functionality of the API. Now, I could change my own API because no one else is consuming it, but I think it's a good practice to get into versioning and getting the habit of versioning.
Absolutely.
So that if you were to provision access for other developers, you have that already in place and everything plays nicely. And I will have... apps that people don't update, right? So I have to have versions. If I update the API and I change how some methods interact,
right,
then the new version of the app can go out with the V2 API in it, but the old versions it'll break. Yeah,
right.
So versioning is important and really should be done from day one.
Yeah,
but who does that?
Day zero if you're a programmer.
That is if you use zero-based arrays.
Which all programmers inherently do.
True.
If you ever
there is some language that uses non-zero based arrays. Yeah, I can't remember. It's like Lisp or something like that.
Sounds right.
Yeah, I don't know.
Jack wagons.
Pretty much. Lisp programmers are jack wagons. Mm. Paul Graham, I'm talking to you.
Almost almost as bad as Lua programmers.
Mm.
Assholes. I'm looking at you, Blizzard. Hey, why don't we just make a whole gaming system where all of the scripting language, like everything, it's awesome, multiplayer, massively, whatever. But no, if you want to script anything, it's fucking Lua. Lua. Really? Yeah. Lua.
Forget it.
And the same thing with the Corona.
Oh.
The multi-platform OpenGL game app productivity, whatever
thing.
Generator tool thing ecosystem. I am running out of adjectives and nouns. they use Lua.
Right.
So you write your mobile app in Lua.
Ugh.
And so I'm like, huh? I love you guys. If only you didn't use this arcane, weird, like bracket-based. I get it. It's like Objective-C. But
yeah, but...
Yeah. Again, ugh. Shakes fist.
Right.
So
I'm going to write a book called The New Cult that is all about like cults of programming languages.
I think you would have a breadth of anecdotal evidence.
Probably so.
A dearth. As it were.
Yes. So this question came up, and at the outset, it seemed very simple. So let's first talk. I want to talk about this. Well, we've just covered basically the why do you version APIs. It's for backward compatibility, not introducing breaking changes into things that other people are consuming,
but
et cetera.
Before we skip ahead to the how, I want to actually take a moment and I promote a new idea that I've been working on in this whole, you know, startup philosophy world, which is there's a book. Is it Seth Godin? Start with Why?
Yep.
Yeah. I think that's a good idea.
No, Simon Sinek.
Simon Sinek. That's right. Yep. Sorry. hey, we're actually doing real-time errata today. This is
no.
Surprising, given bourbon.
No kidding. Maybe the bourbon helps.
Yeah, it's like fact serum. It is actually probably that.
It is most definitely that.
but yes, we like the idea of starting with why. A lot of companies, a lot of teams, they start with how or what.
Right.
And what is important and how is important too. But why is more important. But I think even more important still is who.
Ah.
So I think you should start with who, because understanding who will help you understand how you get to why. Because who implies a certain personality, and that implies a certain set of goals. And that so the who leads to the why, leads to the what, leads to the how.
So who is the who?
In this case, the who, I'm pointing again at the recorder, which really just makes no fucking sense at all.
Is the recorder consuming our API, the Drawer API? Perfect.
Let's hope so. So the who in our case is two sets of people. And it's something we do in user experience design world and talk about personas.
Mm-hmm.
So as, you know, applying some of the user experience practices, design practices to the developer world, so what we've commonly referred to as DX or developer experience,
yep,
a sort of a subset. That means sort of it implies that we have different kinds of developers. They're not all Steve. They're not just one persona of developers and they're all just Steve.
Right.
It's not. There's also other developers. Although I'd like to believe that there are lady names in there. I don't think there are. It might be Ruth. That would be like a good lady name, lady programmer persona name.
Oh.
But no, like there are different kinds of people. So there's going to be people who are stagnant, who did some work. They referred to your API early in their development process.
Yep.
They rushed through some stuff. They saw what your existing documentation was at the time that they were doing the development, and they implemented everything, perhaps with a 2012 date stamp.
Right.
If you read back to our previous episodes about Justin's woes
right.
with the Foursquare versioning API. So it does kind of, this extends from that conversation.
Yep.
But there are going to be people who do that. And so they built their API and their app is now stable. They didn't do anything with it. It hasn't added any new features or that sort of stuff. And so they just go on about their merry life and their app works. They don't have to contact you because your API integration with them works. You know, they're happy. Everybody's happy. Users are happy. Everything's good. Then there's another user, another developer persona. We'll call him Philip.
Okay.
Philip has to deal with a lot of feature requests. He's working in a startup. He has a lot of pivoting going on. They haven't really found their spot, and they're trying to figure it out. Mm-hmm. And as a part of that, they're exploring the options of what APIs have. But they're sort of hopeful that maybe you might release new features. Maybe Philip is more active on pull requests mm-hmm. to your API, you know, your GitHub issues and what have you. So I think Steve has a very different experience with the API than Philip does, because mm-hmm. Philip is dealing with constant pressure from his boss. We'll call him, what's the name of that the boss from Office Space?
Oh,
Lundberg. Yeah, we'll call him Lundberg.
Yeah,
he doesn't
Bill.
Need a persona because he's an idiot.
Yeah.
And actually has no influence whatsoever.
Which is funny because when you said boss, I was going to say Bill is the name. This is the first name that popped into my head.
Bill Lundberg.
And then I realized that is actually the same. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's funny.
So Philip has to deal with these feature requests and has to constantly keep up with your API, because he's checking your API weekly, probably the specs, or like he subscribed to your newsletter, he reads your blog, whatever.
Yep.
And he wants to know when you release new versions. There's this interplay in all this, and the interplay is how frequently do the consumers, the users, the developers in this case, how frequently do they need access to this information? How frequently do they need to know that it changes? How frequently does it change? And how do you manage that interaction as a provider of an API? I think that kind of sets the stage for that, and that gets us into the why. I talked a little bit about a why scenario
there. Yeah.
I think the who and the why are very tightly
very similar, right? Yeah, but it should be clear that when you have an API, when you create an API, either just for yourself, for your internal development team, or for other people who are consuming it, you have a lot of responsibility to the other people to do this right and to design this in a sensible and sustainable way.
Yeah, and despite how cowboy we are in the vast majority of every moment in life. We are actually pretty diligent about this design stuff.
Yes.
Not necessarily in our own APIs, but the things that we deliver to clients.
Right.
You know, we want that to be an industry best practice, robust, whatever. So I definitely do a lot of, you know, rigorous design consideration for web services when I'm working on them for clients.
Yep.
Less rigorous for when I'm doing internal cowboy stuff, but in the end, when you're publishing something, before you publish it, it has to be stable enough that if you found it off the street, you could pick it up and go, oh, okay, this is how this works.
I understand.
Like IKEA Easy.
Yep. Absolutely.
So that's why we spend all this time thinking about this stuff, because somebody has to put that shit together. And there's those weird stick figure faces of the guy with the pointy nose and the rounded forehead.
Yeah.
But like squared off legs. That guy has to, he was like, well, wait, what's the HTTP put? Is that what it is? Where's the Allen wrench? I don't even.
Huh?
It needs to be easy enough that you can figure out how to use it and actually get to the point where you're using it and getting real data back within 15 minutes.
Right. Yeah.
If you can't, then it's too hard and you need to spend more time on the design, more time on the documentation, hire a new architect, or all of the above.
Yeah. Right. Probably all of the above.
I would say hire me, but I'm unavailable.
That's right. Yes, you are. You're committed.
Committed. In every way that you're
going steady, as it were.
Is there a prenup?
Oh, yeah.
Because I don't think I have anything worth.
That's called an NDA.
Oh, touche. That's like a topic for another conversation.
Yeah, no kidding, right? Prenups and NDAs. Things that ruin relationships. Startup prenup.
I like it.
That's awesome.com. So let's talk about the how for a moment.
Okay.
We know why. We know who. Let's talk about how you actually do this. Because versioning APIs As I have found, it's not as simple as it seems. So let's talk about two pieces of it. And the first one I want to talk about is one that was very evident to me and I thought was very obvious. But in some research I did last night or night before, whenever the hell I was tweeting about this, I came across some very interesting arguments for URL design. Now, the I would say one of the kind of standards as far as URL design that we've seen is to put the version in the URL. So it would be like root slash V1 slash
or
endpoint.
Date stamp in the case of...
Or date stamp, whatever. Right.
Foursquare shakes fist.
Right. Well, and Foursquare is passed as a query param.
Yeah. Which
right?
is even,
not part of the path.
I mean, you can make the argument that they are the same thing and it's just how you interpret it on the server side.
So another way you can do this is passing the version in a request header.
Right.
And
there's a couple. You could do a date stamp as a header. You can do a version as a header.
Right.
You can do a version as a query string param, as a path param.
Yep.
Date stamp as a query string param or path param. Yeah, there's all these sort of methods you could do it.
So interesting, I came across a blog post that made the argument that the request header was a better place to put version information than the path.
I'd like to hear this argument.
Here's the argument. It's that in a RESTful design, the path represents a resource. And you are not requesting V2 of the resource. You're requesting V2 of the API. And so by putting V2 in the path, you are injecting incorrect logic into the representation of the resource.
I already have a counter.
Okay.
Why did the resource change? How did the resource change between those versions? If the resource changed by schema change, like there's new data now,
then it makes total sense.
It would be namespaced as a different
version.
If it changed, if the way you interact with it or like some triggered secondary behavior, like in the truck spotting API, when you update your truck, you update the latitude, longitude, and the way that we display the location of the truck.
Yeah.
That triggers a secondary action of generating a ping record.
Yep.
So that we can show you a history of where your truck has been over time.
Yep.
I mean, there's lots of different ways we could do that, but that's one of them. Now, if for example, we added the ping feature, like the breadcrumb trail in a second version of our API.
Yep.
Then the first version, you would still be posting, you know, latitude, longitude, display location, for example. And there is no triggered behavior. But, like, the thing you're posting doesn't change, so the attributes don't change. But maybe the way that the behavior changes in the back end.
Mm-hmm. Maybe it returns an extra field or it calls something
different. It returns a field,
different,
or a header.
Right.
Triggers. It may even actually produce exactly the same resource back to you, like head okay, 200 okay. It might send you back the attributes that you sent. It may send you back the whole object. It may send back nothing. But the social contract between the client and the server is what you're versioning, not the resource itself.
Right.
But it may be a little less like more tightly coupled than you expect because of the schema problem.
Yeah.
If you change the schema, as an example, you might post an address and the return, the resulting object has geocoded latitude and longitude, which is something I just built yesterday, for a real estate listings app.
Mm-hmm.
That's a triggered behavior. So you, in a form, type the address, first line, second line, city, state, zip. And when you submit that information in the background, it resolves that to a latitude, longitude, so it can show it on a map.
Yeah.
Maybe the version one of that is just the address metadata. You post that, it sends back the full record. Here you go. But maybe version two is, you post the address and it sends back the address and the resolved latitude and longitude.
Yep.
And now you have a schema change between the two versions.
Right.
Now, this gets really into the weeds, actually, because then we can talk about versioning individual endpoints. So this is where the header thing becomes an interesting scenario, because if you have the need to version individual endpoints separately, then the header design makes a lot more sense.
Because you can just include or not include the header.
Well, exactly. But more importantly, you can do away with namespacing in the path sense, which is what I use.
Yeah.
Like, /API/VX/the endpoint.
Yep.
And they're all RESTful endpoints, so they all act like standard CRUD Plus, we do some extra things, but if the thing that you're posting to changes, like maybe you release a new version, like for example, again with the truck spotting API, right now we have trucks, and we publish that as a published endpoint for developers to connect to. So you would be able to, as a developer, build an app that hooks on, authorizes the truck owner, and now the truck owners can, when they check in, they can, you can have some extra, you know, secondary behavior that your app provides that ours does not.
Yep.
But maybe in a version 2, we release something with menu items and the ability to do ordering and that sort of stuff. Now we have released new endpoints. Endpoints that did not exist at date stamp now, but will exist at date stamp 2 weeks from now.
Right.
Or whatever it is.
Yep.
So if you're using a header design to deal with the endpoints, you might actually go far enough back in time that the endpoint doesn't exist at that version of the API.
Mm.
So if you're at a version 4, let's say, of your API.
Right.
Major release 4.0, let's say. And you have added things over the years, and now you have these extra things, and somebody tries to access those new things on the old path, they will get a 404.
Right.
Presumably, or maybe a 500 if you're not doing your job, bro.
yeah, exactly. Right.
So,
which could be a very confusing response, because you don't know if it's a 404 record not found or a 404 path not found.
Exactly. Resolving those ambiguities, especially if you're looking at an individual record where you have a primary key, a collection, a scope with a primary key, and you're saying, oh, it's a 404, but I can't tell if it's 404 because like trucks doesn't exist or because trucks 68 doesn't exist.
Right. Right.
So.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So, those cover some of the reasons I've had to use new versions of APIs. I want to ask you to explain some of what triggered you to consider versioning, like a major version. Like, why? What are you adding? What are you changing about your API that you feel that necessitates a new version?
Yeah. So that's a really great question, and God, we don't have enough time in this episode. It's a really great question, and it actually backs into the other cascade of questions, which is, so let me try to think of a very specific example of how this might change. For example, in Drawer, we're getting ready to really change a lot about how the interface is designed, about how the people interact with the app.
Mm-hmm. As I saw from the deluge of GitHub issues last night.
Yeah. I was setting
it was
up
like 40.
I know. I was like going through and just like basically road mapping out the new version.
And it was like per wireframes.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, major changes to this per wireframes. I'm like, wow, useless, man. I didn't see the wireframes.
I know. I should attach the wireframes to all the GitHub issues. If it wasn't just me working on it, I would. yeah. That's funny. But so there are some endpoints that we have. What was the one I was thinking of? Got it. So for example, right now we have an endpoint called latest activity. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the best named endpoint, but don't worry about that.
Is that like a global, like everything in the whole system that's changing?
It's essentially, if let's say you're a user and you follow a bunch of people, that endpoint returns all the activity of your followers.
But is it only followers? So if I don't follow anyone, does my activity feed just empty?
Yes.
Okay.
That latest activity would have nothing in it.
A Twitter feed for George.
Right, exactly. So it'll return like if people follow you, if people you're following, ad places, that type of thing, right? So it's this, so user/activity isn't really the correct path for it. So I just went with latest activity.
Right.
I probably could have just been /activity, but that's also it's a difficult one to name, but
yeah.
Either way,
the more specific you are, the better.
Yeah. So in the new version, that's going to change. Like now what's going to happen is we need an endpoint for global activity and activity for just the people you follow.
Oh, okay.
And then things that say right now, the latest activity endpoint would show you, like, let's say somebody followed you. It would show up in that endpoint, right? Mm-hmm. In the response from that endpoint.
Right.
In the future, that's going to be moved to something called notifications. So okay. we're separating activity and notifications out separately.
So you're making notification a first-class object.
Right. Whereas now activity would be somebody you're following did something, but follows, like, things they do unto you is a notification, right? They sent you something, they followed you, that type of thing. So, anyway, hopefully...
Wow, I feel like I'm in Bible class all the time. You use the word unto.
I know. That was my years at the United Methodist Church coming out. So I want to raise up this issue so we can talk about and lift up this issue in for conversation.
Yeah, raise up. That sounds like zombie reification. You know,
so that was one of the big things, and I was like, oh, shit, I can't... So I can create a separate notifications endpoint and move all this, but that's going to, there's going to be this fracturing of the functionality.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was what got me thinking, you know what, I should probably just make this a new version and change, because all the architecture, that whole activity handling is changing. Mm. And so it's a pretty big logic change in so far of how the data is handled and how it's displayed to the user. And that to me felt like it necessitated an incremental change.
Right.
A version change. Oh, God. Okay. We're gonna quickly go through this. So that's the thing. So let me get to the heart of my question.
As it will be your only one.
As it will be my only question. I couldn't wrap my head around, and I still can't wrap my head around, actually technically how to do this. So in the example...
So now we're finally into the how.
So now we're into the how. Okay. And what this is about is this... In Rails, it probably works very similarly to Node. You have a router, and the router says, here's paths and here's methods.
Right.
And if it's get at this endpoint, go run this method. And if it's put at this input, go run this method.
So is there a controller? It defines a controller and an action on that controller, maps that to a path string.
Exactly.
With some placeholders for resolution of things like dynamic primary keys or query string parameters or other things in the path you might want to do.
Exactly.
Scoping, namespace.
So the question is, it's very simple. Do you copy your entire router and remake the whole thing with V2 in the path? Mm-hmm. And then do you copy every single controller and do that? So you basically have two APIs running alongside each other, which feels horribly inefficient and terrible. Or is there a better solution for me? Like, because if I change activity, I'm not going to change anything about how users are created in V2. But I need that V2 endpoint to still resolve correctly.
Right.
So how do you... technically execute that?
So what I would say in the 1 minute that I have to answer this question,
lightning
unless,
round,
unless you want to do a second episode, but what I would say is that the controllers exist for things that aren't changing already. So if you have a V2 controller and you're going to a V3,
right,
you probably already have a V1 that's different from the V2,
right?
Maybe that endpoint is changing, so you make a new controller to handle the different behavioral things. Or maybe you have like a filter before something. You might want a super class. Now, see, this is where it gets into the ambiguous, it's very situationally dependent. You may want to make a V3 controller that is a subclass of V2's controller if V3 is a minor upgrade or like a minor addition or change to the V2 behavior. If the V3 behavior is totally different, then you don't want a subclass. You want to just generate a new controller entirely.
Yeah.
But so what I would say is, yes, you want to make a whole set of namespaced controllers that are like a class. Even if the class is empty and all it does is inherit from its predecessor and define nothing.
Yep.
That's it. It just inherits from the old thing, just so we can have a placeholder to differentiate from the other class, so that your routes can point to that class instead of this class.
Yep.
The new class instead of the old class, and then override behavior as needed. It is a little messy in the sense that it feels like copy pasta, where you're just basically copying a whole bunch of shit into the new path or whatever it is.
Basically, double the size of your API immediately.
Right, but. You're not, because if you're doing it intelligently where you're subclassing another thing to inherit its behavior, you're essentially saying programmatically, this is a social contract that says this object isn't changing in this new version. But at least you have like from a readability perspective, it's much better because you can now look at the code. If a you know someone's coming in to look at defects or you're going in to muck around with some behavior, you're making a new version, your version 4 or whatever, you're going to refer to the latest version. If you refer to the latest version and the latest version is actually just a subclass of the version before that, then it's easier for you to track where that original code, where the executing code actually lives.
So right.
I think it feels a little bit like copypasta, but you get the benefits of readability and maintainability over the copy pasting. Now, I don't recommend copying all the code and like that's a terrible idea.
Right.
Subclass
yeah.
and override. That's a
right,
much,
yeah.
much better platform. And we are out of time.
All righty. There you go, folks. Version your APIs and do it the good way.
Right. The right way.
The right way.
The smart way.
The smart way.
The best way.
Okay. See you guys.
Thanks for listening, folks.